any well-implemented set of agreements needs to allow for the vulnerability of human hearts and the unpredictability of life. Rules that cause problems. We've seen certain relationship rules among poly people fail again and again. The following agreements have proven to be fraught with problems and require great care if you attempt them. Don't ask, don't tell agreements. In these arrangements, a person says, "You can have other lovers, but I don't want to know about them." This often indicates that someone wishes the relationship weren't poly at all and hopes to pretend it's not happening. This charade makes it impossible to communicate about important things, or for new partners to verify that the relationship is in fact open. Wherein a "don't ask, don't tell" is a favorite lie that monogamous cheaters use to explain why you can't just call their spouse to check out whether the relationship is really open. Rules that require a person to be sexually involved with another, or that require some other form of service. When you make sex or intimacy with one person the price of sex or intimacy with another, you plant the seeds of coercion, as discussed in the section titled Service Secondaries. Rules that fetishize or objectify people. We have known people who treat a partner's other lovers as fetish objects, demanding detailed blow-by-blow accounts of every sexual encounter for their own gratification. Your partner's significant others are not your sex aides unless they consent to having the details of their sexual encounters shared with a third person for the purpose of arousal. They have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Rules that restrict certain things, places, activities, or sex acts to one partner. These rules are often seen as ways to protect the specialness of one relationship. A person who does not already feel unique in her partner's eyes, however, is unlikely to gain greater self-worth by restricting others from special things. And over time, the symbols of specialness, like Bob's Crab Shack, can start to be more important than the actual fact of specialness. They begin to feel hollow, because they are. The feeling of specialness actually arises from all of the daily ways in which we invest in a relationship and express love. Such rules also court disaster, when the lists of limited activities become, as they may over the years, long and complicated. Layla's story. Molly and Jeff are a married couple, with a notebook filled with rules, including a detailed list of which sexual activities are permitted with which partners. When Layla became involved with Jeff, the rules in the book were applied to her too. One of the rules was that Layla could not touch another partner on an area of the body covered by underwear without Jeff's permission. Layla assumed underwear meant briefs. Jeff assumed boxers. While on a date, she touched a new partner on the inner thigh. This led to recriminations and accusations, with Jeff claiming Layla had violated an agreement. After the relationship ended, Layla described to us the feeling of trying to navigate these labyrinthian rules. She said, "A rule is not just an agreed-upon avoidance of consequences. Rules-based systems judge your moral character based on your adherence to the rules. It's a contract that frames things as acts of betrayal and leaves the betrayer buried under moral judgment. The guilt or potential guilt in that situation is like breathing acid." Love me, love my partner rules. Human beings don't fall in love at the same time, in the same way, at the same rate, with two people at once. It just doesn't happen. And when rules make assumptions about sexual access to somebody's body, if you have sex with me, you must have sex with my partner too, they can quickly overrun personal boundaries or even become coercive. Sex with one person becomes the grit-your-teeth price that must be paid to have a relationship with another. Such rules discourage honesty. If your new partner loves you but not your partner, will she tell you that, knowing that telling you means being kicked out? Rules that specify what happens if one relationship runs into trouble. For example, there could be a rule that other relationships must be ended or scaled back. When a couple agrees, if we run into trouble, we'll drop any other relationships to work on the problem. They treat their other partners as disposable things. If a couple had three kids and decided to send two of them into foster homes to focus on the problem third one was having, we might call them monsters. This kind of behavior is also a questionable way to treat romantic partners. Rules that are disguised as personal preferences. Sometimes a person might present a rule as just a statement of personal preference. An example from Franklin's experience is a married couple who had a rule that the wife was not permitted to have any male partners. When Franklin asked why this rule existed, she said it was just her personal preference. She didn't want any male partners. So why, then, was a rule made at all? This was a big warning flag of underlying issues in the marriage. It took about 2 years for the wife to admit that, yes, she really did want male partners. She'd said she didn't to reassure her husband, who felt threatened by the idea, and obtained the rule at what seemed like no cost to anyone. It took another 5 years for the dust to settle. In the end, she was able to have another boyfriend, but it took a lot of unnecessary turmoil and drama to get there. As uncomfortable as it was for her husband to come to terms with her hidden need, 2 years of him naively believing that she didn't want other male lovers only made him feel worse about the reality when he found out. Honesty from the beginning would have saved everyone considerable grief. Paging Dr. Munchausen. There's one rule, quite common in hierarchical relationships, which we believe is particularly dangerous and deserves special attention. A rule that a person who is sick, injured, or in crisis will only be supported by the primary partner. Other partners are not permitted to care for that person. This rule was part of Franklin's relationship with Celeste. You will often see caring for someone in need billed as a way for a primary partner to preserve a sense of intimacy and specialness. Caring for a partner is one of the most loving things we can do, but the idea that only one person should be able to do it is very troubling. When someone is sick or injured or in crisis, the focus should be on that person. Rules that say only the primary can provide support divert the focus from the person in need, shifting it to the issue of who can do what. Worse, if a person's sense of specialness or intimacy depends on caring from someone in need, that's codependency. In its most extreme form, it becomes Munchausen by proxy syndrome, a recognized psychiatric disorder. When someone is in the hospital or laid up, this is not the time for displays of territoriality or ego. Writing it down. Good fences make good neighbors, or so they say. Many people who give poly advice will urge you to write down and even sign your agreements. The relationship contract is quite common in polyamory and is growing in popularity, even among monogamous people, or so we hear. Mark Zuckerberg's wife famously negotiated a contract with him, guaranteeing 100 minutes of his undivided time for her each week. These written agreements can range from a few sentences on a post-it note to, in one case we've seen, approximately 48 pages of single-spaced type. Certainly, there are many situations in which explicit written agreements are just common sense. Eve won't do business with a new client without a contract, and usually a deposit. It's too easy, even for honest people, to remember a verbal agreement very differently from each other, or for one to genuinely forget they even made it. But while written relationship contracts might seem like a good communication, they contain a hidden trap. Communication is a dialogue. A contract, especially one that's presented to new people as a done deal, very often isn't. Communication and discussion are essential for the health of any relationship. This is why, as we have said before, we see agreements as far better than rules. The difference is that agreements are mutually agreed to among equals, but turning an agreement into paperwork too soon can become an expression of power. We've seen two different types of written relationship contracts. Those that are written when all the people affected come together to work a solution to a problem everyone is facing. And preemptive contracts. The one set of people, often a couple, writes down expecting any new partners they meet to sign on. Some written relationship agreements are intended to address only a particular narrow subject, such as safer sex boundaries, or whom the partners can be out to, or whether a veto exists and how it may be used. Some people have found it just as helpful to record that veto does not exist as to record that it does. Such a reminder can be helpful when times get rough. Other agreements include some of the provisions mentioned above concerning permitted or forbidden sex acts or restaurants, ranging all the way to pet names that new partners are not allowed to use. We even know of one contract that limits playing certain kinds of strategy war games to only certain partners. In general, written agreements are more successful when they are short enough to remember without needing to reference them often. Generally, less than one or two pages long. Have a narrow focus, are intended to solve a specific problem among a specific group of people, concern only those people present in negotiating them. In other words, I will do this for you, not others will or will not do this, or I will or won't do this with others. Include statements of goals or intentions, the purpose of the agreement, such as Eve's wedding vows, and are flexible and open to review and negotiation. Written agreements tend to work poorly when they are lengthy and highly detailed, attempt to define or regulate every aspect of a situation, affect people who are not present in negotiating the agreement, prescribe specific actions to implement a stated intention, that is, allowing only one way to get there, attempt to control things beyond the control of the negotiating partners, such as future intimacy or the behavior of others, allow no room for renegotiation or change. Successful written agreements are documents that you hold yourself to, not something others hold you to. They are reminders to yourself of commitments you have made and tools for communicating those commitments to other partners. They should not be used as devices to shame, manipulate, or punish. And remember our ethical axiom, the people in the relationship are more important than the relationship. If you find yourself haggling over clauses in an agreement and whether they have been violated, rather than discussing the hurt feelings, the needs behind a partner's actions and ways to make amends, you've probably reached a place where the people are serving the rules and not the other way around. Perhaps the most serious danger in written contracts is when they are inflexible. The longer and more complex they are, the more they are likely to be trying to script a relationship or treat people, at best, as a threat to be managed and, at worst, as a commodity. If one partner is finding herself unable to hold a provision of agreement, there's a good chance the agreement needs to be renegotiated to work for all partners, and not that she is dishonest or doesn't care about the agreement. People who keep long, complex written agreements often build relationships that are unable to change when their needs change. They often spend a lot of time rules lawyering. Consider the story of Layla and Jeff. Imagine that you were looking for a conventional monogamous relationship, and on a date, somewhere between the Caesar salad and the barbecued shrimp, your date pulled out a 48-page document and said, "This contract spells out how our relationship will go from here. Sign here, here, and here, and initial here, please." You would quite likely find it off-putting, especially if the contract specified that you couldn't play Scrabble, couldn't go to Bob's Crab Shack, and were expected not to engage in oral sex. All so that your date's best friend from college wouldn't feel threatened by you. Good written agreements are instead reminders of our own boundaries or commitments. One very short contract we've seen contains elements such as, "My partner is important. Do your chores before going on a date. Don't spend joint money on your own dates. And don't fuck it up." An agreement that's about what you will each do to care for each other is a very different thing from an agreement that tells new partners how they are expected to behave. We urge those of you considering written agreements to draw up short, specific lists of boundaries or intentions, rather than long, complex documents that tell others what they are and aren't allowed to do. Ultimately, remember that your relationship belongs to the living, feeling people involved in it, not a list of rules. Make sure that people, not pieces of paper, are always at the center of your relationship. Drop the permission model. A factor that often portends failure of a rule is whether it's linked to a permission model of relationships. This is the idea that when we enter a relationship, we give up control over our actions to our partner. If we wish to do things like enter into another relationship, visit another partner, or take a new lover, we must seek the permission of our existing partner. As soon as we start a relationship with someone, that person becomes the gatekeeper to all our future relationships. In our experience, relationships that provide everyone in them the most happiness follow a different model. The people who seem happiest in relationships start with the premises, "I can have the kind of relationship I want. I can make choices I want to. My best course of action is to learn to choose the people who want something similar, to take responsibility for the consequences of my choices, and to pay attention to the effects my choices have on the people around me." When evaluating agreements or structures, look also to the language built into them. Watch for the slippery words we talked about in the communication chapters. Respect is one of those words. You can hardly argue with it when faced with the provision that says, "You must treat me and my other partners with respect." You would say, "Well, you know, I think I'd rather be disrespectful." Most people will agree to such a provision without a second thought. But what exactly does respect mean? If respect means be subordinate to, it creates a very different relationship dynamic than if respect means take seriously and treat with compassion. The best agreements are not the ones that steer people away from bad things, but rather ones that point us toward good things. We both subscribe to the radical idea that the best way to create security in a relationship is to create happiness. The people in the relationship are more important than the relationship. To that end, when you make agreements, look for the ones that move in the direction of greatest happiness. Franklin's partner Sylvia likes to say her primary relationship rule is, if I am not a positive aspect of your life, I don't want to be in your life, and vice versa. While it sounds simple, that approach to relationship requires courage, especially the courage to know that you can lose a relationship that does not make you happy. And that's okay. Game changes. When we open our hearts to multiple relationships, every now and then someone comes along who changes everything. This is one of the truths of polyamory, rarely talked about. The game changer. A game changer is a relationship that causes us to rethink all our relationships, and maybe even our lives entirely. It may be a relationship with someone who fits with us so naturally that the person raises the bar on what we want and need from other relationships. It may be a connection so profound that it causes us to look at our lives in a new way. It's a relationship that alters the landscape of life. A game changer doesn't even have to be a good relationship. It can be one that's dysfunctional on such a deep level that it changes what we look for thereafter. A game-changing relationship is invariably disruptive. It makes us see things in a new light. It opens us to new ways of thinking, or perhaps answers needs we didn't know we had, or didn't think could be met. Because of that, game-changing relationships are scary. Indeed, they are arguably one of the scariest things that can happen in poly relationships. Many rules in poly relationships can be seen as ways to control the fear of a game changer. Franklin has experienced not one, but two game-changing relationships, both of which substantially rearranged his life. Given how scary and disruptive game changes are, many people try to set up barriers to prevent them, erecting fortifications to protect their lives and hearts from disruption. In practice, this is often about as effective as building a tornado shelter from straw. Love is a powerful thing. Sometimes it transforms us. Not only are structures designed to prevent game-changing relationships unlikely to work, it wouldn't necessarily be a good thing if they did. Change is scary, but that doesn't make it bad. There is nothing noble in trying to preserve the status quo from things that can make our lives better. Unfortunately, when a game-changer happens to someone who's already in a relationship, it tends to concentrate the wonderfulness in one place, but spread the disruption around. So when your partner starts new relationships, you may feel compelled to seek reassurances that things won't change for you, at least in ways you don't like. It can feel very reassuring to extract a pledge from your partner that you will always have some measure of control. Good luck with that. Game changers change things. It's in the name. They upset existing arrangements. People confronted with game-changing relationships will not be likely to remain happy with old rules and agreements for long. The definition of a game-changing relationship is that it reshuffles priorities. Expecting an agreement to protect you from a game-changer is a bit like expecting a river to obey a law against flooding. Being a parent is not a protection against game-changers. In chapter 13, we told the story of Clara and Elijah, a married couple with children who separated after Clara's game-changing relationship with Raymond. Of game changers, Clara says, you realize what's really important to you in a relationship and reevaluate what you have. She doesn't regret the decision she's made, despite the changes they've caused to her co-parenting relationship. Game changers are not just a poly thing. They happen in monogamous relationships all the time. Nearly half of marriages end in divorce, and game-changing affairs are one major reason. Sometimes game-changing events have nothing to do with romantic relationships. A promotion, a baby, a car accident, a job loss, a death in the family. All these can permanently and irrevocably alter our lives and our relationships in ways we can't predict. We accept the reality of game changes all the time when they don't come in the form of romantic relationships, as happened in Eve's life. Here is Eve's story.
Arguably, the biggest game changer in my marriage was my mother-in-law. In 2008, she had a massive stroke that paralyzed her on one side. In just a few minutes, this active, healthy, youthful 67-year-old woman became completely dependent on round-the-clock care. That stroke represented a seismic shift in my marriage, dictating our priorities, budget, and travel schedules for years. Peter made the 10-hour round trip over the mountains to visit her and his father every 2 to 4 weeks. In 2012, he went to live with his parents for over 8 months to assist his father, who was facing burnout. Few would fault him. Elder care is accepted as something that often is a game changer. And yet it resulted in significant strain on our lives and our relationship.
We understand that no promise of forever can stand up to the number 39 bus with bad brakes that puts someone in a coma. These are the risks we take when we open our hearts to someone else. Sometimes things really change. Relationships take courage. Still, polyamory complicates the emotional calculus in new ways. Relationship game changers feel more frightening than other kinds. Whether it's insecurities that whisper that others are prettier, smarter, and more deserving, or the social fable that romantic love connects us only one person at a time. Or the idea that every new connection our partner makes takes away our specialness, as though specialness were a currency sitting in a bank account somewhere, available in limited quantities, with substantial penalties for early withdrawal. Relationships seem uniquely able to push our buttons. The desire not to lose what you have because your partner meets someone new is rational and reasonable. What is neither rational nor reasonable, though, is attempting to build structures that allow your partner to have other relationships while guaranteeing that nothing will change for you. Relationships don't work that way. We live in a world with no guarantees. And now, here's Franklin's story.
I spent my first 5 or 6 years of non-monogamous relationships trying very hard to create a system of rules that would guarantee I always felt safe and in control. When I didn't feel safe, it seemed like I hadn't found quite the right rules. So I returned to the rules, tinkering with them, adding exceptions and new clauses, searching for just the right combination that would protect me from changes I did not want to face. In the end, this strategy didn't work. When the first game-changing relationship came along, neither I nor Celeste were prepared for it. I met Amber, who is still my partner as I write this. She tried very hard to fit herself into the space we'd carved out for her with our rules, and something profound happened. For the first time, I was able to see how contorting herself to fit into the space left by our fears and our desire for safety hurt her. As soon as I saw that, the relationship became a game-changer. Had we been more flexible, or had Celeste and I been more open to the possibility that parts of our relationship could change and we'd still be okay, I might have been able to accommodate the new relationship in a way that allowed me to strengthen my bond with Celeste, and my life would look very different now. That's the funny thing about fear of change. Sometimes, the more rigid we are when we insist we do not want our lives to change, the more catastrophically things break when change comes along. I handled my own game-changing relationship poorly. Rather than face down my fears, having the courage to accept change and the flexibility to adapt to it gracefully, I had become so invested in the idea that polyamory would not mean changing my existing relationship that on the day this became impossible, I had no tools for handling change.
The starting point to a happy poly life is the ability to say, our relationships can change. And that is okay. My partner and I can still build things that will make us both happy, even if they don't look quite the way they do now. As we've said, this takes courage, and it means having trust in your partner and yourself. From there, the next step is to say, even if things change, I have worth. I believe my partners will make choices that honor and cherish our connection. Whatever may come, because I add value to their lives, I will build relationships that are resilient enough to handle change, flexible enough to accommodate change, and supportive enough to create a foundation that welcomes change. Change is the one eternal of life. What I have now, I will cherish, and what we build tomorrow, I will cherish without fear. Life rewards courage. The game changer that turns everything upside down might just leave you in a better place. The only real control you have in your relationships comes from working together to express the things you need, even while change is happening all around you. Questions to ask yourself. Relationship agreements work best when they do not impose limits on what form new relationships are allowed to take. When they serve the needs of all people involved, including the people yet to show up, and when they are flexible and adaptable as you change and grow. These questions can help guide you towards ethical agreements that work. When considering an agreement, what is the purpose of this agreement? Does the agreement serve the purpose it is intended to serve? Is this agreement the only way to serve this purpose? What will happen if someone breaks the agreement? Do we have a path for re-establishing trust? Is everyone affected by the agreement at the table in negotiating it? Can the agreement be renegotiated? When renegotiating an agreement, are the needs now the same as the needs when we agreed to this? Has this agreement been successful in meeting the needs it was intended to meet? Has anyone been harmed by this agreement? Is this agreement serving the people involved, or are the people serving it? Part 4. The Polyreality. 15. How polyrelationships are different. It will be a little messy, but embrace the mess. It will be complicated, but rejoice in the complications. It will not be anything like what you think it will be like, but surprises are good for you. Nora Ephron. Despite what you may think, after the past 256 pages, most of the time polyrelationships are pretty much like monogamous relationships. There's coffee and movies and cuddling and sex and talking, meals and arguments and chores and balancing the house accounts. Okay, maybe there's more talking. Plenty of situations are unique to poly, though, and many things that crop up in monogamous relationships involve special considerations when more than two people are involved. And there are a few poly bogeys, scary situations and problems with no easy solutions, which no one really likes to talk about, which exist all the same. In part 4, we go deep into the nuts and bolts of poly relationships, things like time management, sex, and yes, those scary, no easy solution problems. We've already talked about the idea of the relationship escalator, the script deeply ingrained in monogamous culture that defines the default path for successful relationships, from dating to sex to living together to marriage and kids. You may jump off the escalator and start again from the bottom with someone else, but the assumed goal is to find the right one for the trip all the way to the top, at which point you're done. As we've said, polyamory can free you from the relationship escalator, allowing you to grow relationships that nourish everyone in the ways they need the most. The variety of poly relationships is, as we've mentioned, huge. We can't make assumptions about the shape or path of your relationships. However, most poly relationships do pass through certain stages, things like new relationship energy and the start of a new relationship while in an established one. These stages present uniquely poly challenges. Here are some places where poly relationships diverge from monogamous relationships and the old templates no longer apply. The timing of new relationships. There's no perfect time for a new relationship to start, nor a set schedule for how quickly or slowly it should develop. Sometimes opportunity knocks at the most inopportune times. New relationships are wonderful, joyous, and stressful. Attempting to script how and when they develop amid your existing ones is like trying to corral elephants. These things have a certain inertia of their own, and sometimes all you can do is learn to be nimble on your feet. Some people prefer to start new relationships infrequently and to impose a moratorium after a new one begins to allow it to grow roots. Others choose not to start a new relationship if there are problems in any existing relationship or during times of turbulence or stress. Still, others prefer to remain open to new relationships whenever connections might occur. None of these strategies is always effective. Allowing relationships time to solidify before taking on new partners is not a guarantee that new partners won't be disruptive. And being open to new relationships all the time doesn't necessarily mean a lot of romantic churn. To some extent, the approach you'll take depends on your personal poly styles. People who favor a closely connected network of intimate relationships tend to decline opportunities for new relationships, shortly after taking a new partner, whereas people with a more solo or independent poly style are more likely to be open to relationships whenever and however they form. New partnerings can often feel threatening or, at the very least, destabilizing. This is where many people adopt another strategy, moving at the pace of the slowest person. Move at the speed of the slowest person is such common advice in poly discussion groups that it's become a trope. Making sure everyone has time to process changes in a relationship, especially big changes, certainly has its advantages. The gotcha is move at the pace of the slowest person can turn into a pocket veto. Not now, not yet. Can, if unchecked, quietly become not ever. If one person is urging others to slow down, there must be a recognition that she needs to show she is making some progress towards being comfortable with things. Otherwise, move at the speed of the slowest person turns into don't move at all. If no movement is a person's intent, they should say so up front. Rushing into a new relationship can lead to instability, but moving more slowly than what's natural for the relationship can also damage it. Relationships, like living things, have a natural pacing and rhythm. Artificially limiting a relationship's growth can leave people feeling hurt and frustrated. Counterintuitively, it can cause a relationship to be more disruptive. Imagine how much more desperate Romeo and Juliet felt because their parents tried to keep them apart, and how much less turbulent the story would have been if their parents had said, "Yeah, you two work it out." In any relationship, it pays to check in often with yourself and your partner about the state of the union. Is it growing in ways that serve your needs? Is the pace of the relationship appropriate for your mutual desires? Does it cause unnecessary difficulties for your other partners? New relationship energy. Few things raise trepidation in the hearts of poly people faster than new relationship energy, NRE, as it's unaffectionately known. It's that crazy, giddy, I can't stop thinking about you, everything about you is marvelous feeling that you get at the start of a new relationship. The biochemistry of NRE is becoming fairly well understood. During the early stages of a romantic relationship, our brains go a little haywire. Several neurotransmitters, most notably dopamine, serotonin, and norepinephrine, are produced in greater quantities, generally producing emotional effects that are part attraction and devotion, part obsessive-compulsive disorder, part mystical experience, and part physical lust. We become infatuated and twitterpated whenever the person is near. In this state, we're biochemically predisposed to overlook their flaws and faults, see the best in everything they do, convince ourselves that we are meant to be with them, and crave their attention. When people make distinctions between love and being in love, what they describe as being in love is generally something like new relationship energy. Psychologist Dorothy Tenov coined the term limerence in 1979 to describe a state of romantic attraction characterized by intrusive thoughts of a person, overwhelming fear of rejection by that person, and powerful obsessive need for reciprocation. Limerence, in other words, is what we feel when we fall in love with someone, regardless of whether they like us in return. New relationship energy is limerence in an actual new relationship. For the partner of a person starting a new relationship, NRE is scary stuff. The overwhelming feelings can make existing relationships feel drab by comparison. Worse, the tendency to idolize new partners can easily trick us into making too many commitments too quickly, which can create chaos in the existing relationships. We're not saying NRE is a bad thing. On the contrary, it's transcendent. NRE lets us start a relationship bathed in delight. There's a reason this biochemical response exists. The excitement and giddiness can help lay the emotional foundation for a rewarding, loving partnership. But to make it through NRE while preserving our other relationships, we need to recognize it for what it is. Nurture our other partners when we feel it, and not mistake it for love. We've seen a lot of policies in poly relationships designed to mitigate the effects of new relationship energy, but none that seem terribly successful. When it comes to people's brain chemistry, rules and agreements have a way of falling by the wayside. A more effective way to deal with a partner's NRE involves both communication and patience. The good news is that this biochemical madness doesn't last forever. The bad news is that it can last as long as 2 or 3 years. Patience is important, because a person experiencing NRE literally isn't quite in their right mind. Communication is important too. When you observe your partner behaving in ways that make you feel insecure, neglected, threatened, or taken for granted, you need to say so. Patience in communication is also key, because a partner in the throes of NRE may not hear you the first time. When you're the one experiencing NRE, mindfulness is the only consistently successful strategy we've seen. Be aware that you're not in your right mind, that your perceptions are distorted, and that your judgment is impaired. Don't make life-altering decisions while intoxicated. Don't pledge your life to this marvelous person you met last week. Be aware that you will be predisposed to neglect your existing relationships, and try not to do that. Be willing to do a reality check. A particularly insidious pattern can set in when the hormonal cocktail begins to wear off. A person who doesn't understand what's happening may become convinced that the relationship is no longer interesting and was probably a mistake from the start. And she starts casting around for a new relationship, which she pursues with zeal, until that NRE wears off too. In monogamous culture, this takes the form of short-term serial relationships. In polyamory, this pattern can present as a series of ongoing relationships that began explosively and then wither from neglect. In either case, the chemical high of NRE is mistaken for love, and the sufferer seeks the next new hit like an addict. Some people also implicate another neurotransmitter, phenylephelamine, PEA, in attraction and pair bonding, though this assertion is still controversial. Some studies have suggested it plays a role, but other studies have not supported this conclusion. Living together. Being involved with multiple partners complicates the logistics of cohabitation. When many people first hear about polyamory, they envision a bunch of people living together in a commune. While that does sometimes happen, it's really not that common. More often, we see households of two or three people, some or all of whom may have non-live-in relationships with other people. Some of those other people might have live-in relationships with their other partners. As we've said, there's no standard model. Whether the people in a poly relationship live together depends only on their own needs and choices. After all, just because you love Eunice and you love Taj, and you can see yourself living with either or both of them, that doesn't necessarily mean Eunice and Taj can live with each other. Not everyone wants to live with even one lover. Some folks prefer having their own space. In fact, for people who practice a solo model of poly relationships, living alone may be vastly preferable to sharing a home, regardless of how committed the relationship is or how long it continues. An entire class of problems can appear when we do live with multiple partners. Living with anyone in itself can be a source of stress and discomfort. A friend of ours likes to say these stresses aren't poly problems, they're roommate problems. We don't tend to consider live-in romantic partners the same way we think about roommates, but a lot of unnecessary suffering can be avoided when we employ the same strategies as for non-romantic roommates. Strategies like negotiation and clear expectations around dishes in the sink, household chores, basic courtesy, respect for other people's sleeping schedules, and a willingness to clean up after ourselves. Take laundry, for instance. Who does the laundry in a polyamorous relationship? In the monogamous world, that job tends to get assigned by default, more often than not, along gender lines. In poly relationship, we negotiate everything, including division of domestic labor. Talk about who does the laundry. In Eve's household, as in many poly households, there's an agreement that whoever has a lover over to the house changes and washes the sheets afterward. Commitments in poly relationships. The huge variation in poly relationships means there won't be a clear roadmap for what commitment looks like. Some folks argue this means polyamorous relationships can't be committed. Naturally, we disagree. Though, we will say commitment in poly relationships is quite often different from the monogamous template. In monogamous culture, many commitments look like the relationship escalator. People who start dating each other and continue a while often expect a commitment to stop dating other people. Most monogamous dating couples who don't break up will eventually live together. Most people living together who don't break up will eventually feel the need to commit to get married, owning property, and maybe having kids together. There are less tangible commitments as well. Most monogamous couples would probably agree that they have a commitment to seeing the relationship continue as long as it can. Most monogamous couples have a commitment to one another's well-being, which might mean anything from bringing chicken soup to a partner who's sick, or driving a partner to work if her car breaks down. Part of the beauty of poly relationships is they can look like almost anything the people involved want them to. But that means poly people are responsible for consciously designing our relationships. It's essential to be crystal clear when making commitments, and to never assume a commitment unless it's been explicitly stated. Simply being in a relationship with someone is not a commitment to the traditional relationship escalator. A pattern is not a commitment, and an assumption that it is can lead to a feeling of entitlement on one side and confusion on the other. Polyamory means creating relationships deliberately, not making assumptions about what they should look like. If you want your partner to make a certain commitment to you, don't assume, ask. If you are uncertain what commitments your partner thinks he or she has made, ask. And be realistic about what commitments you can make. This means not just being realistic about your other commitments now, but about the flexibility you may require in the future when a new person enters your life. One challenge with polyamorous relationships is they require a willingness to leave space for other people who have their own needs and desires. This means that some types of commitments are especially problematic in poly relationships, and the need for flexibility on everybody's part is much greater. For example, longer-term commitments are trickier than short-term ones. I can easily commit to a date with you next week, but to commit to a date with you the same night every week forever, that overlooks the fact that I may someday have someone new in my life, and that's the only night she can see me. Or maybe I'll someday want to go to Mexico for a week with her, which will mean cancelling our date night. Commitments to always put one person first in certain things, or to always restrict certain activities to one person, can become problematic if someone enters the picture for whom one of the restricted activities is important, and everyone needs to be put first sometimes. And then there are commitments that specify how other commitments are to be met. I commit to sharing equally in our parenting responsibilities. It's very different from, I commit to never spending the night away, so that I will always be there for the kids' breakfast. Similarly, I commit to living with you, remaining your ally throughout your life, and looking after you in old age, is different from, I commit to never living with anyone else, never being a lifelong ally to someone else, and never taking time away from our relationship to care for another partner who needs help. Another type of commitment that can trip you up is a commitment to future intimacy. Many of the commitments we make in relationships, like legal and financial responsibilities, a shared home, or children, are actually commitments to life-building, not feelings, and not to never changing your boundaries. When we're head over heels in love, or feeling NRE, we may want to promise to love our partner forever. We may even want to promise desire for them forever, as much as we do now. But as much as you may want to build a life with someone, consent to intimacy exists only right now, right here, in this moment. Consent means that you will be able to choose at all times the intimacy you participate in. Being in a consensual romantic relationship means you are never obligated to any future intimacy, meaning anything that enters your personal boundaries. It can be sleeping together, having sex, hugging and kissing, sharing emotions, living together, having certain shared experiences, or making shared choices. You can state future intentions, but you cannot pre-consent, and both people must recognize and respect personal boundaries in the present time, regardless of intentions stated in the past. This is important to understand, or else the relationship can easily become coercive. Many people build structures against free exercise of consent in the future to protect themselves from their fears. Never leave me. Love me forever. Such statements are you or your partner asking for future control of the other's feelings and choices. But even if you have already made such promises, you can always withdraw consent, or withdraw new boundaries, or it's not consent at all. The moment you begin expecting any form of intimacy from a partner because of a commitment he has made to you, or ignore boundaries because you feel your partner has no right to set them because of a prior commitment, your relationship has become coercive. Financial commitments in polyamory need special attention. It's common for people in a relationship to combine their finances. In Poly, we believe it's important to have access to some money that's just yours, even if you have joint finances with another person. This avoids one source of resentment and conflict. We have seen many people get upset when they feel a partner is spending joint money on dates with someone else. This opens an avenue for control. A person who doesn't want his partner to have other relationships can simply forbid using their money to do so. When each person has some amount of money that is theirs to use as they wish, this helps eliminate the feeling that one person is subsidizing another's romantic life. Commitments and solo poly. Advocating for needs and navigating commitments can be a special challenge for solo poly folk, whose relationships don't follow the usual script. We're accustomed to judging a relationship's significance by how far it's gone up the escalator. So when we don't see the conventional markers of a serious relationship, we may underestimate its depth and how much investment has gone into it. People who take a free agent approach often look for partners who value them and their needs, even when the relationship doesn't follow a traditional trajectory. So it's often not their partners who misunderstand the importance of their relationships, but their metamors. A partner's other partner can easily trivialize a relationship that doesn't appear committed because it doesn't have the normal markers, such as moving in together, that society associates with commitment. Here is Franklin's story.
Amy and I started dating in 2004. Amy is solo poly, and our relationship has never been on course for the two of us to share finances or live together. During the time we've been partners, she has always maintained a high degree of autonomy, living by herself and making her own decisions. We didn't have a plan for our relationship. We let it take its own path. In the years since, we have always been there for each other through good times and bad. We have celebrated joy together, held each other through heartbreak, supported each other through the occasional bumps that any partnership faces. Despite that, we've never felt a need to develop a more traditional relationship. It has sometimes been difficult for other people to recognize how committed Amy and I are to one another. This has been true with partners of mine who don't understand how we can really be committed to one another if we aren't planning an entwined future, and to partners of hers who don't consider ours a real relationship because, despite all the years we've been with each other, we haven't made any move toward living together. At times I felt it necessary to stand up for our relationship against assumptions that it can't really be serious, and she has had to set boundaries when new or potential partners consider her entirely single because our relationship is almost invisible to them.
Many solo poly people, when considering a relationship with a person who is already partnered, find it essential to talk about their expectations and ideas about commitment early on. Long-distance relationships. When you look around at poly people, you'll see a disproportionate number of long-distance relationships. Often you'll see deeply committed, long-term LDRs, something that's fairly rare among monogamous people. Monogamy makes assumptions that are poorly suited to distance, and it's difficult to maintain sexual exclusivity for long periods when your partner is far away. But because polyamory doesn't necessarily include expectations that partners will live together, and because it doesn't restrict sex and intimacy to one person, long-distance poly relationships are more feasible. Another reason you see so many is that many poly folks meet online, and because poly people represent a relatively small portion of the population, the selection of local poly partners can be limited. Our relationship with each other is long distance, and Eve has one other LDR and Franklin three. Long distance relationships exist in a constrained space. Time with a long distance partner is scarce, meaning it's at a premium whenever the opportunity comes up. But there are many ways to nourish an LDR when the partners are apart. The two of us, for example, spend a lot of time on Skype, and we're both avid texters. The time when long-distance partners are physically together, surprisingly, can create the most stress. When you have both local and long-distance partners, as both of us do, and all our long-distance partners do, it can be easy to get so caught up in the normal day-to-day relationship with a local partner that you forget to make space for the distant one. Sometimes, literally. A long-distance partner can be a sort of invisible person, someone whose needs aren't necessarily obvious. For example, do you leave a place in your home for your long-distance partner to stay on visits? If you have a regular schedule with local partners, every Friday is date night, say, are you flexible enough for a long-distance visitor to interrupt that routine? Local partners may resent visits that disrupt regular schedules. When your long-distance partner in town, naturally, you want to maximize the time you spend with him. From the perspective of a local partner, the visits can look like all grapes and no cucumbers, a distinction we explain in the next chapter. You may go out to eat more often, take trips, spend more time playing tourist, and do other fun things to make the most of the limited time. Your local partner might end up saying, "Hey, when do I get to have that fun?" If your long-distance partner visits for a week and you want to spend every night with him, your local partner might say, "That's not fair. When do I get to spend the night with you?" The answer, of course, might be during all the other 51 weeks of the year. Long-distance relationships concentrate the fun, flashy parts of a relationship, but at the cost of all the small things that build intimacy every day. We know few local partners who will be willing to trade places with a long-distance partner. LDRs also create special concerns around relations between metamors, because visits may not allow much time to build metamor friendships. The partners in the long-distance relationship may need to sacrifice some dyad time to allow for metamors to get to know each other. Metamors, for their part, need to be able to recognize the scarcity of time the long-distance partners have with each other, and realize it's probably not personal if they don't get as much time as they'd like to get to know the long-distance partner. Because distance makes time such a valuable commodity, flexibility from everyone is vital. Polyamory with children. Polyamory can be tremendously positive for children. We have both seen or been involved in polyamorous relationships with people who have thriving, happy children. Polyamory potentially means there are more loving adults in the family. It allows children to see more examples of healthy, positive, loving relationships. It exposes children to the idea that love is abundant and can take many forms. Evidence-based research on long-term outcomes for kids raised in poly families is still scarce, but a 15-year longitudinal study by the sociologist Elizabeth Sheff, summarized in her 2013 book, The Polyamorous Next Door, highly recommended reading if you're a poly with children, found that the kids from poly homes are often strikingly robust and emotionally healthy. Though she admits that her sample has a self-selection bias, her generally positive conclusion about kids in poly families match observations that are common throughout the self-identified poly community. Children of poly parents grow up with adults in all kinds of configurations. Many poly parents end up living with a non-parental partner, some of whom have kids of their own. It's quite common to see live-in Vs consisting of a couple with children plus another adult partner who often participates in childcare and may have a close step-parent-like relationship with the children. Quads and quints, bigger networks, living in a great big house with six or seven kids, it's all been done. Some non-parental partners are more like aunts or uncles, some more like friends of the family who don't have much involvement with their partner's kids. Some, but not many, poly people hide their poly relationships from their children, seeing partners outside the home or treating them as friends. We talk more about coming out to children and coming out with children in Chapter 25. There is no magic formula for poly parenting, no configuration that will work best for every family. The strongest, healthiest homes for children are those with happy, emotionally healthy adults who model integrity and good communication. The child's needs must be cared for, and the parents absolutely need to be present for and committed to their children. But that does not mean sacrificing their own needs, happiness, or interests to every want of the child. Most people seem ready to accept parents' complexities and trade-offs for other things, such as careers. Not just when both parents work, but when a parent needs to uproot the family to move cross-country for a career or educational opportunity. It's really not so different for relationships. If you have children, or plan to have them, and you want to open up to polyamory, it's worth taking some time to unpack your ideas about what it means to be a good parent. Our society has long idealized nuclear families, but there are all kinds of families, including plenty of children who grow up without traditional nuclear families. A lifelong live-in romantic dyad is not the only healthy or acceptable way to raise children. And, in fact, the isolated nuclear family is a historical recent aberration. As a polyamorous person, you might end up creating a beautiful live-in quad or triad with dedicated co-parents, not unlike the way your great-grandparents grew up, surrounded by aunts and uncles. Or you might want to lose your romantic relationship with your co-parent. You might end up as a single parent or in a platonic co-parenting arrangement with your former partner, or in something that resembles a monogamous blended family, separated parents living with step-parents. Few things are more controversial among poly people than how polyamorous families with children should behave. Parental shaming is rampant in the wider culture. We are immersed in so many messages about what good parenting looks like, but by the time we get around to having kids, it can be tough to shake off the guilt no matter what we do. Mom, working outside the home? How can you be so selfish? Not working? You'll never afford a safe town with good schools. Don't want to or can't breastfeed? You're ruining your child's chance at a future. Oh my God, is that non-organic baby food? Didn't play her music in the womb? Didn't read to her for an hour a day from birth? There are a million ways for parents to fail, and parents are measuring themselves and others against every one of them. If we don't get it right, our kids will grow up to be drug addicts incapable of intimacy, unemployed and homeless, or maybe they'll just miss their chance at that Nobel Prize, and it's all your fault. Well, polyamorous parents get shamed from all sides, mono and poly. Parent shaming is the next cultural narrative you have to confront after slut shaming. Under these circumstances, creating healthy, ethical, egalitarian relationships when you have children can be especially tricky. Our monogamous friends tell us that when we have kids, we'll settle down, grow out of this poly thing. Our poly friends tell us that egalitarian poly relationships are impossible with children, because without a hierarchical structure, no one would look after the children's needs. Everyone tells us that good parents always put their kids first. But what that means is very culturally specific. Everyone thinks they know what's best for kids, and damn near everyone is ready with judgment and blame when the parents they know, truthfully, usually the mothers, fail to meet their expectations. Add the fact that poly people are in a PR war in which we're putting our happiest, most stable and photogenic poly families out in front, and that gives poly parents just one more thing to measure up against. In her 2013 book, Lean In, Facebook CEO Sheryl Sandberg discusses parental shaming, unrealistic expectations of mothers, and research concerning childcare responsibilities and child well-being. The research she cites shows that stay-at-home parenting is not the only healthy way, or even the best way, to raise children. Some data even suggests that kids do better without parents who are dedicated to filling their every need 24/7. Very young children, of course, may need 24/7 caregivers, but these do not have to be parents. In fact, children benefit from being able to attach to adults other than their parents, often grandparents, aunts, uncles, or a close friend of the family. And they often benefit from group settings such as daycare. As Sandberg says, guilt management can be just as important as time management for mothers. Are you okay with the idea of raising your kids in a family that doesn't meet the societal script of a romantic dyad? Do you believe you can still do right by your kids if you end up raising them in a home with one or three or more parents, something that looks different from what you expected? Or will you feel you have failed your children? If you're going to live in fear every time your partner is away with another partner because you believe that if you can't maintain a primary romantic dyad, you'll somehow be harming your children, then you might want to reconsider whether this is the best time for you to make the leap into polyamory. Children certainly do complicate time management. Young children especially require huge time commitments from parents. It's essential to be realistic about how much time you have available to invest in romantic relationships, including with your co-parent, and whether that time is enough to allow you to treat another partner well, especially if a relationship becomes serious. And making a rule that a relationship can't become serious will likely lead to problems, as we discuss in chapters 10 and 11 on rules and hierarchies. If you or your co-parent are extremely fearful of the loss of time for your children that another relationship might represent, again, it is worth considering whether polyamory is a good choice for you at this stage in life. One final thing to consider is the situation of new parents. Many thoughtful people try to space out new relationships, allowing time for each to become secure and established and aiming to understand the impact will have on their lives before opening up to another one. A new baby is also a new relationship. And given the emotional upheaval, life changes and sleep deprivation that come with having a new baby, this is an especially good time to be cautious when deciding whether you are available for new connections. In fact, many established relationships, both mono and poly, end due to the stress brought on by the birth of a child. Remember, whatever your reasons, if the circumstances of your life do not allow you to treat multiple partners ethically, then it is not ethical to seek them. Many people say that a new baby makes it hard or impossible for them to treat new partners with compassion. If that's the case for you, it's not a good time to start a new relationship. What about marriage? Poly relationships may be live-in or separate, local or long-distance, sexual or non-sexual, entwined for life or autonomous, open or closed, shared or networked, or entirely independent. Given that, some people ask, why would a polyamorous person even bother to get married? But many people are polyamorous and married for all sorts of reasons. Eve and Peter have been married for 4 years, together for more than 14. On their wedding day, they'd been living polyamorously for 2 years. His two other partners and their partners attended the wedding. On the whole, it's not Eve's monogamous friends who are puzzled by her marriage, it's her poly friends. Why get married if you're not going to spend your life with one person? Isn't marriage a remnant of couple privilege or an archaic approach to relationship? Isn't it about ownership? Here is Eve's story.
When we decided to get married, Peter and I had been together for about 9 years. My relationship with Ray had forced a major reevaluation of my life with Peter, and in the course of that, we came to the realization that the future we were building together was lifelong, and we wanted it to stay that way. And watching Peter's father take care of my mother-in-law, severely disabled from a recent stroke, drove home the importance of having people in your life who are deeply committed to you, people you know you can always rely on, no matter what. We were married a year later. These were the